VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I'm joined by Patty Barkley, Allison Rudd, and from the Great Northwest, James Ducker. We'll be discussing all the latest football action. And we've got a bumper Premier League review, City beating Chelsea, Liverpool against Sunderland, and of course, the Baggies, boing, boing, winning at Emirates. Regular listeners will notice that we normally pick out two games in our Premier League review, but it was such an eventful bumper weekend that we actually went out and we picked out three. So I implore brevity and wit from everybody here so our producer Chris doesn't freak out. And let's get the ball rolling. So Manchester City and Chelsea. Some people said, oh, well, Chelsea, you know, they're so impressive, 5-5 and 21 goals scored, one goal conceded. Wait till they play a real opponent. Well, they played a real opponent in Manchester City. And they lost. Patty.
Well, it was the first thing that needs to be said is this was Manchester City winning a game, not Chelsea losing a game. I'd be interested in James's take on this because we were there together. And I certainly felt that it was a terrific high-intensity football match. I went there expecting a 0-0. And really, it was, apart from one piece of particularly poor defending, it was a 0-0 sort of game.
Sorry, if I jump in there a second.
No,
because I watched the game on my television, and the number of times I heard people talk about the two Italian managers, and it's an Italian game because it's going to be 0-0, and, you know, unlike the two Italian managers who took charge of Fulham and Everton and had that boar fest later in the day, but I digress. And yet you're talking about a wonderful high-intensity game. Was it intense? It wasn't just two teams playing at a slow tempo,
hyper-defensive? I haven't seen tackling like that for a long, long time. I mean, De Jong, for me, had Tevez not been invented, De Jong would have been the man of the match. I mean, it was like razor wire. I mean, it was like being attacked. It was really terrific because it was fair tackling, you know.
His distribution was wonderful as well.
Oh, he had a great game.
Yeah.
And so I think that he kind of epitomised the match. It was played at a very high level of work rate, intensity, and tactical appreciation. And I genuinely felt that this, from now on, you know, Manchester, whatever we have, a big five, a big four, a big two, a big one, Manchester City are in it. Manchester City, life will never be the same again after Saturday. Manchester City are a big, big club.
Ducker?
And we'll win the league sooner or later.
Ducker, you're the Northern football man. Do you agree with Paddy's analysis?
I do. I hope it doesn't sound boring saying so. I couldn't agree more with Paddy. I mean, I've listened to all sorts of criticism of the game. You know, Match of the Day studio, you know, the people who were there, the highlights reels and that kind of thing. I just couldn't get it. I just thought I thought from Mancini it was an absolute tactical masterclass.
Yes.
I mean, people have kind of criticised him for being overly cautious, but I mean, how is he supposed to set up? Is he supposed to set up completely openly against a team that scored 21 goals in 5 league games?
Yes.
I mean, even Ancelotti, I know the mates, but even he applauded Mancini afterwards, which said it all. Really, I mean, you know, Ancelotti's not going to say that kind of thing lightly. And I just thought, I don't know if I describe it as absorbing, but it was absolutely intriguing.
Yep.
It was a fascinating kind of game to watch, really.
It was.
And I mean, we go on and on about, you know, entertaining, you know, loads of goals, all that kind of thing. But, you know, it was just really, really refreshing and nice to see that kind of game in the Premier League.
It was just porous defences,
you know.
Yes.
You know, obviously a great, great, great goal, but just, you know, general calamity.
It reminded me of a match, one of the best football matches I've ever seen was the World Cup semi-final between Germany and Italy in Germany in 2006. And I mean, I came across my notes for the game. It ended 2-0, two late goals for Italy. I came across my notes for the game, and until the last couple of minutes, I'd made sort of two notes each half. There was no goalmouth incident to speak of, but what a match. What a match. And this kind of slightly reminded me of it. And yes, I love watching Arsenal. I love watching loads of chances at each end. But my word, a game like this is really refreshing too.
Okay, I'm going to jump in and interrupt this this love fest between Ducker and Barkley. I don't know if I... Do I have to be the person playing devil's advocate and criticising the negative tactics of Roberto Mancini? Or will you do that, Alison?
Well, I was going to suggest that maybe it wasn't so much great tactical acumen on behalf of Mancini, but that's the way he plays, and it so happens to be the way Chelsea hate facing. Mm-hmm. They're very strong through the middle, Chelsea, very physical, mm-hmm. Very pacey, but it's all through the middle. And Man City have, under Mancini, been incredibly congested centrally. And if Chelsea made a mistake, it was not, you know, they could see that Ashley Cole was an out for them. They didn't try and make that happen because they don't have the personnel to do that. But I wouldn't go so far as to say it was sort of genius on Mancini's behalf. I think he just has the team that Chelsea cannot play against.
I should point out.
I think it's a little bit harsh to say City at congested midfield. Their best player, with the exception of Tevez, since January has been Adam Johnson, who's offered them all sorts of options going down the right or left.
Yeah.
And, you know, when they get Balotelli fit as well, I mean, I can imagine him being played, you know, in a wider position by Mancini. Yeah. He'll offer that. I mean, David Silva, we've started to see in the last couple of weeks, that, you know, once he finds his feet a little bit more, he's going to be a player.
Yeah. It's not as if he's some guy who managed in Outer Mongolia before coming here. I mean, there is a long body of work from Mancini. Mm. And I don't think it's that difficult to figure out what he's trying to do, and the fact that his body of work suggests he's not been a defensive manager. Far from that. Certainly at Lazio he wasn't, and at Inter Milan he wasn't. And people get bogged down in this three defensive midfielders.
A sort of wild Italian attacking manager wouldn't qualify as an attacking manager over here.
No, I know, but nobody's talking, well, Zeman possibly, but...
I think one of the points, Gabriel, can I just quickly say, well, I think one of the points is that from a defensive point of view, City was so haphazard under Mark Hughes that, and Mancini has obviously realised that is the first issue that needed to be addressed, and he's done that. I mean, for the risk of repeating what I've written today, you know, Mancini's conceded 19 goals in 27 Premier League matches in charge of City. That's 0.7 goals a game. His 11 clean sheets he's kept. Under Hughes, 55 league matches, 77 goals conceded. That's 1.4 goals a game. So they're conceding half as many goals in the Premier League under Mancini than they were under Hughes. So I think, obviously, people see that, and for rightly or wrongly, people are viewing him as a defensive kind of coach, and really just actually addressed the problem.
We're not really talking about top of the table Chelsea, but I just want to bring up some things. I think Ancelotti was criticised was Drogba's substitution late in the game and putting on Sturridge. Conventional wisdom might suggest, you know, you're behind, leave the big man on, you never know, a set piece, a header.
Yeah. Free kick.
Ancelotti said, oh, and I wanted Sturridge's quickness. Mm. Alison?
Well, it backfired because Sturridge didn't play very well. I mean, if he
was
had...
Was Ancelotti mad?
No,
stupid.
Sturridge...
He played better than Drogba did.
Yeah, well, exactly. Drogba was not playing well. And Drogba has very many games where he doesn't play as well as he should and could. But had Sturridge done what Sturridge can do, everyone would be saying, well, you know, he did exactly the right thing, didn't he? He just didn't expect Sturridge to be that... You know, he was coming back to Man City. You know, sometimes it can make a player do amazing things and be their moment, and it just wasn't Sturridge's moment.
Arsenal and West Brom. And now, I was just struck at one point. I flip over to West Brom, and you know, like, they've got the sort of possession last 10 minutes stat, and it was like 57% to West Brom. And this was in the first half when it was still 0-0. And I was kind of flabbergasted because Arsenal were at home, and you know, West Brom were passing side. But when's the last time you see that? Is it? I mean, obviously, we saw a bit of this with Mowbray, but are West Brom that good at passing side, or was something seriously wrong with Arsenal on Saturday?
I would venture there was something seriously wrong with Arsenal. I mean, I saw West Brom at Chelsea and I thought they're going to take a long time to warm up in the Premier League. You know, they're not dreadful, but there was very little to indicate that they would be able to go to the Emirates and dominate. And it was interesting. The most interesting thing I thought was that Wenger disputed that Fabregas not being there was the reason that their composure was sort of shattered and it just didn't click for them. But Fabregas, I think, has been astonishingly good this season, really good. And I think without him there, they looked a bit lost, actually, a bit helpless and a bit lost. And it took them to be three goals down before they discovered that sort of spirit, which I think they have from the word go when Fabregas is in the team.
Tucker, I would have thought the Song, Diaby, Danielson in midfield, those three guys, you would at least win possession and stop West Brom from passing it around like that.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very bad day at the office. I kind of loathe to read too much into it. I mean, I'm certainly with Alisson that Fabregas is, you know, has just looked, you know, phenomenal this season, and his absence was quite clearly felt. I think, you know, probably been a very different game if he'd been there. But yeah, I mean, like you look at the team, you know, they should have been good enough to beat kind of West Brom. But I just think it was a spectacularly bad day at the office and a very good one for West Brom. And I still think West Brom, as nice football as he plays, still going to be in the bottom five or six at the end of the season.
Ooh, he's throwing a marker there because, of course, they are in fifth place right now with an Italian manager, no less, albeit a guy who's really Swiss and probably more lived in England, I think, longer than he's lived in Italy. Paddy, I want to bring up one player, obviously, who stands out. We talked about him, but Peter Odemwingie, he's a great story, of course. You know, half Russian, half Nigerian. Yes. Bags of talent. We've been talking about him most of his career. Hasn't always lived up to it. What do you make of that? I mean, is West Brom the right team for a guy like that who brings that pace, that directness?
Wonderful signing, because I mean in all their various guises, West Bromwich, you know, you mentioned Mowbray when they played nice passing football. Then they went down, they come back up, and always the problem with them is that there hasn't been that cutting edge. You know, it's that bit of razor pace at the end of it. So this guy is—it's like a marriage made in heaven, you know. This also, they're really developing as a side. They've got some good players now. Dorans is a good player, and one of plenty of others. And they have a philosophy. You know, I find myself so often saying this, that it really does help, if whether you're Stoke and have one particular philosophy, or whether you're West Bromwich and you have another philosophy. Once you've got that philosophy, you've got a chance. And so I'm delighted. I thought it would be a great game. It was a game that I wanted, you know, if I'd been able to choose my match on Saturday, I would have liked to have gone, because I thought it would, I was absolutely confident it would be a feast of football that would end Arsenal 4, West Bromwich 2. So there you go. I think they're great. As far as Arsenal, if I might just briefly say on Arsenal, it occurred to me that Manchester City have done them, because if Manchester City had let Shea Given go, Fulham would have sold Schwarzer to Arsenal, and Arsenal would be an infinitely better team than they are now. But I still think that Wenger's been too mean. I think he needed to buy a central defender, because Koscielny is not ready for the English Premier League and probably won't be until the second half of the season.
Think Skolasie, Vermaelen, when fit, with Giroud in reserve, gives you enough cover?
Yeah, I think it does, but...
It's the two of them together, isn't it? Koscielny and Skolasie. They're both new.
Yes.
They're both new and looked a bit lost.
Yeah. I think they'll be all right second half of the season. They'll be fine. They're just dropping too many points at the moment. I think that if they had Mark Schwarzer in the team, they would be up there with anybody to win the title this year.
You mentioned the Arsenal goalkeeper there. Nobody's mentioned him by name. He obviously had not a good day at the office. Tucker, this guy, a few years ago, when it seemed like he could get a British passport, there were people wanting him to play for England. Do you remember those halcyon
not
times?
Not that many. Not that many people. Not that many people. It's one of those things that...
Most of them were journalists, weren't they?
It's one of those things that got a ridiculous kind of, you know, momentum.
Yes.
you know, I just, anyway.
Well, here's a question, though. Would you,
probably the less said about that, the better. But
not to belabor the point, but would you rather have Almunia in goal for England or Arteta in goal for England?
Oh, we've got, I've actually seen Arteta in goal in training once for Everton, so I'd probably go for Arteta.
Brilliant.
There you go.
That's my God, he'll think twice before taking you on again.
I'll tell you what though, Paddy, I mean, as you say, yeah. I'm a big kind of fan of Arsene Wenger, apart from when he's bleating,
yes.
You know, beyond all belief, but I mean, I cannot get my head around the whole goalkeeping situation this summer. It's almost like, I know he wanted Schwarzer, but he obviously didn't go the whole hog for him. And it's almost like he's just deliberately kind of trying to do things his own way because everyone else is saying, look, you need a goalkeeper.
Yeah. He does like the high wire, doesn't he?
Yeah, and it's kind of like, look, Arsene, you know, you're a great manager. We all know that. You don't need to kind of prove yourself on stupid points like that. You need
the Almunia thing is that Arsene Wenger believes he is a good keeper, and the only reason he's not a good keeper is because the media have a go at him and might undermine his confidence.
Yeah.
And so Wenger sees it as a battle. Yeah. He doesn't want to give in to the fact that his keeper might make the odd blooper because his confidence is undermined. So he's out to prove a point that the inherent talent of the man will see him through.
We need to move on because smoke is now coming out of Chris the producer's ears. So I wanted to raise a question about Arsenal's financial results, which were obviously exceptional, and whether this was all part of a grand plan so that in 2 years' time, when UEFA's financial fair play
comes in,
financial fair play regulations come in, all of a sudden Arsenal will be in a position where they'll be compliant, unlike most of the other clubs, and they can just go and buy up everybody in sight and become, you know, the master club forever. However, we won't have time to discuss this because you guys would all rather talk about Manuel Almunia. So I'm going to throw this to Allison, who I know can provide a succinct answer on this one without upsetting Chris the producer even further.
Well, they won't be going out to become some Uber club with Wenger in charge. Wenger loves the fact that he is the only manager that operates within a profit and can bring through youngsters and spot talent cheaply. If suddenly the regulations change and he's the only manager who's allowed to spend money, he won't do it.
Wow, interesting. So then Arsenal will just keep making more and more money, which I guess is good news for Arsenal's shareholders. Moving on to a team which has a slightly different financial situation. Liverpool, home to Sunderland. Before we start, we got to turn to the qualified ref here. I don't know what to say anymore about Stuart Atwell beyond the fact that he managed to make both managers very, very angry, which I guess at the least shows that he's not biased. So you know Atwell's unbiased. Is he competent or was he competent on Saturday?
He was competent on Saturday. Mm. The problem with Atwell is that he doesn't... he's 27, he looks 22, he lacks authority on the pitch, and 90% of being a successful referee is you look the part. Howard Webb, while he was away, he had a break after the World Cup, he spent his time in the gym, and he was at... I know you're all saying,
Alison, you know him well. Was he doing this to defend himself in case Nigel de Jong decides to come and karate kick him?
He's been in the gym, and he's come back, and when he ran out onto the pitch at Craven Cottage on Saturday, I'm not joking, he looked the fittest man on the field.
He looks kind of like a Greek god, doesn't he?
He has beefed out. He is tall. And the point was, in that game, it was nil-nil, and it wasn't quite as dull as some of my colleagues have made out. It was quite tricky. The point is, he made several decisions that were borderline. You know, you can take them one way or the other, and nobody argued with him. He looked, don't mess with me. And Atwell's problem is he has been fast-tracked. He's made some stupid errors in the past. He's only 27, doesn't look the part. But it so happened that at Anfield. He did everything absolutely spot on.
Paddy, do you need to be big and beefy to send Stephen Gerrard off for going and elbowing somebody in the face?
This is my complaint about referees like Howard Webb. Yes, he looks the part, but he doesn't. I don't remember ever seeing him punch a player. And I think it's about... I mean, what's the point of them being big and beefy if they don't actually use their physique? I mean, Emil Heskey used to be criticised for this, for not punching his weight. And I think a lot of referees who look scary, Colina, for example, never actually used their physical.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Power to hit players who thoroughly deserved it.
Okay, while Paddy advocates physical violence from referees towards players, Tucker, I'd like to get an answer about Stephen Gerrard. To me, it seemed pretty obvious. I thought he should have been sent off. He didn't just lead with his elbow. He elbowed him in the face. In fact, I don't even think he got off the ground with that header. There was no need to do that. I thought what he did was dangerous. Am I completely wrong here?
No, I think you're absolutely 100% correct. He caught him flush in the face. I had a look at him first. It's another case of Stephen, I'm, you know, too big to ever be punished on the football field, Gerrard. And I just... Stuart got one decision majorly wrong at the weekend.
We haven't talked about one of the more curious incidents yet, which, of course, was Liverpool's early goal. For those who are living under a rock and haven't seen it yet, he awards a free kick to Sunderland inside their half. Michael Turner standing over the ball. I'm just going to describe what Turner actually does. I'm not going to try to guess what he's thinking.
Yeah.
He squares up as if he's going to kick it. Then he kind of turns, starts trotting up the pitch, and casually side-foots the ball backwards in the general direction of the goalkeeper, Mignolet. But he does it at a very slow pace. Torres sees, like, oh, good, what's this guy doing? Runs to the ball and then unselfishly sets up Cow in a two-on-one with the goalkeeper.
Yeah.
Now, what I find curious here is, from a refereeing perspective, so I'll go to the qualified ref on this one. All right, to me, I think it makes a huge difference what Atwell and Turner said to each other. We don't know what they said to each other. We don't know what the understanding was. So we have to give Atwell the benefit of the doubt. But from where I sit, if Atwell said, it's a free kick, because if Turner first tries to take the free kick quickly, Atwell makes him back, and then Atwell, I presume he said, take the free kick now, to me, Atwell's in the clear. I don't think Atwell's done anything wrong if Turner then turns and knocks it back to his own goalkeeper. That's his business. And so the goal should have stood, and weird as it looked, I don't think Atwell got that one wrong. And is Atwell wrong?
No, you're spot on. But there's no, you don't have discussions with the referee over those very boring pedestrian happen all the time, free kicks deep in your own half. They're not significant.
So what was Turner thinking?
Turner just had, goodness knows, but he just forgot.
A brain fart.
He may have meant to. He may have suddenly thought, oh, well, I'll move up the pitch and maybe it makes more sense for the goalkeeper to take this, in which case he should have picked the ball up and rolled it to him. But then he shouldn't have thought that because the ball was in exactly the right place. Had the referee having made it clear he wanted the free kick taken from the place it was. So he should have indicated to the goalkeeper to come forward and take it. It was just a silly error, and he must have just sort of, because it wasn't a significant part of the pitch, he must have just sort of forgotten that it mattered.
I can't quite get my head around why there's been so much criticism of it. It was just an aberration from Michael Turner, really. And, you know, Bruce should be moaning at his player, not the referee.
Quick look at Liverpool, obviously more financial stuff, which we won't get into. But I think it's worth bringing up with Roy Hodgson. I saw a stat this weekend that prior to the game, this had been Liverpool's worst start in about 300 years. And I also saw the punditocracy rise to his defense and go and put the boot in. It's all Rafa's fault and Rafa this and Rafa's evil and Rafa's diseased and so on. Let's ask the Liverpool fan here. What percent do you blame Rafa on for Liverpool's poor start to the season?
15%. Yeah.
And 85% Hodgson.
Yeah. And I'm a big Hodgson fan. I really like him as a man and as a manager, but I think his move, I don't think he should have done it. He had everything the way he wanted it at Fulham, and it took him 2 seasons to do it, and he took the toughest job in English football because he thought it might not come to me again because I'm 60 odd. And I just think whatever he's doing behind the scenes, it's not convincing the players and it's not working.
Ducker, are you laying most of the blame at Hodgson, or are you going
to... No, I think Rafa needs to take a hell of a lot of the blame. I mean, Fergie made the very valid point last week that Benitez spent a lot of money, which often gets overlooked in all of this. And come the end, that squad that Hodgson inherited wasn't as good as it should have been after a 6-year period. And then Hodgson obviously lost Mascherano to add to Alonso, who kind of gone before. And, you know, he's not got all the money to spend that he's brought in. And, you know, he's having to start from... You know, I'm not saying he's having to start from where Benitez had to start when he took over from Houllier, but it's not that much different. It's not that much different, to be honest. And I just think, look, you know, the owners are dreadful, quite clearly. But I just think Benitez got out at the right time. You know, it wasn't looking good for various reasons, and I think Hodgson inherited a very, very difficult job, and. I'm not saying Benitez deserves 80% of the blame, but certainly 40% or so.
Okay, we've got numbers day now. Patty, you might end up being the deciding vote here because yeah. Allison says 85% Hodgson, 15% Benitez. Ducker says 60% Hodgson, 40% Benitez.
I would say 0% Hodgson. And I don't even think Benitez did much wrong. After all, he brought to the club such players as Xabi Alonso, Fernando Torres, and so on. Plus a load who were useless. I mean, to go back to what he got when he came, Houllier's cow droppings, according to Gabs. Houllier's cow droppings won the Champions League, as I recall. So that was.
Sorry, when did this happen?
In Houllier's 2005. Mind? 2005.
So was Houllier the manager?
His cow droppings, the team he bequeathed, plus Xabi Alonso, of course, won the Champions League.
And Reina.
But nine of Houllier's players won the Champions League. A two-man team doesn't win the Champions League.
But you're being a bit counterintuitive here because you know that those players include Jimmy Traoré.
I'm being accurate.
And that Houllier's best period, if we want to call it that, was actually several years earlier. And by that point, the wheels had effectively come off.
Yes,
which is why Julia left.
These are players who couldn't have been moved on. It's wrong to talk about, an impossible legacy and so on. Benitez did pretty well with Julia's legacy, improved it, I think, at one stage, before, finally. Nobody ever takes over a perfect club. Unless the manager drops dead. I mean, that's the perception is of a club in decline. Otherwise, they wouldn't change the manager. So that's just routine. The only thing I would say is all Liverpool need to do is give Hodgson a few months. Trust me, we'll be thinking back to this conversation and thinking how knee-jerk were we after six?
I'm not suggesting they sack him after six games
of a season,
including following Arsenal and Manchester United in those six games.
Correct.
That they've had to
after six games of a season, we're talking, in an apocalyptic way. After 14 games at Fulham, Hodgson, having taken over from Laurie Sanchez, had won only 2 out of 14 and expertly steered Fulham from 18th to 19th in the league. That's what he did in his first 3 months. Heavens.
Give him a little bit of time. All I'm saying is the results and performances this season, I am saying Hodgson is responsible for them. I'm not saying he won't improve.
But you can't judge a man on six games. Heavens, if a board did that, you'd call them idiots.
I agree with Paddy. And Paddy, Gav, what you're saying about 40% Benitez, 60% Hodgson, I disagree with that. I said 40% Benitez. I'd say 59% Hicks and Gillette.
Correct.
That's too easy. I'll just say it's 100% Hicks and Gillette. The difficult thing about Hicks and Gillette, and I think we agree that, the producer's freaking out. Maybe we might just ditch the debate today because nobody wants to talk about footballers and philanthropy and just continue with this argument. I wanted to, the thing about Hicks and Gillette, it's obviously a difficult situation, but A, I don't think there's anybody on this island who will stick up for Hicks and Gillette, so it's not going to be much of a debate. But B, Hodgson has to deal with Hicks and Gillette in the same way that Benitez did. Right, so it's not a variable in this equation.
I suppose you could argue that Hicks and Gillette are. I mean, nobody's mentioned a player yet as being responsible, which is quite extraordinary. How do we?
The choice was Benitez or Hodgson. Obviously,
Hicks and Gillette are influential in this sense, in that Torres thought he was joining a club and Stephen Gerrard thought he was re-signing for a club that would be properly funded, would be gearing up for a new stadium and so on and so on. Now, you can call them naive or whatever, but the fact that these guys have turned out to be, I'll have to watch my words here, not what we thought they were, it obviously has an effect on the playing staff, the management staff, and that's really why Liverpool are in very, very safe hands. Trust me on that one. Come back in 3 months.
Can I just say, because you're ganging up on my point of view here, which is fine, is that if you take over Liverpool and you have Torres saying, yes, I'll stay, after it seemed pretty clear at one point that he would not, and you have Stephen Gerrard rededicating himself to the club, and everyone was saying he's off to Madrid. Mm. That should give you the impetus to really, albeit with lots of flaws and problems deep down, but that should give you the impetus to start the season. New manager, fresh outlook, that should give you the impetus, and David Ngog actually playing well for the first time ever, that should give you the impetus to get some more points than they have. And for that, I blame Hodgson. And he should be glad I'm blaming him, because
order! Allison may finish, then Ducker, who's far away, we haven't heard him say, and then Paddy.
Thank you.
Allison.
I don't think Roy Hodgson would particularly like to hear everyone saying, it's entirely down to what happened before. I think he's trying to do something, it's not working. Whatever he's trying to do, it's not working. He will get time to do it right. And if he does, I'll be the first person to say, well done, Roy.
Ducker.
Hodgson is working with a very, very dodgy defence there. Mm-hmm. And that is going to take him, time to address. Plus the fact that his star striker, is out of sorts. Davian and Gog started the season well. I think there's potential there. But I just look at what he's inherited, and it's not that great. And some of the staples of that team under Benitez, you know, Carragher's on the way, Gerrard's obviously not had a bad season, and Torres isn't fit. So, you know, it is going to improve.
Interesting there, and to wrap this up, what I would like is a nice round number, since I love percentages and numbers, as you know. Percent chance that Liverpool will finish in the top four this year. Alison.
Oh, God.
Do I take some time to think about it? I'll go with Ducker first, because he's very quick off the mark. Ducker. Oh, Christ.
10%.
Patty.
25.
10%.
Ducker.
25.
Ducker.
10%.
Rudd.
35.
Oh, Rudd. Mm. Ever the optimist. So unfortunately, with this bumper Premier League conversation, we won't be able to get to the debate this week, which was about footballers and philanthropy. I was going to highlight several episodes of footballers who've been very philanthropic, not least the much-hated and much-reviled Emmanuel Adebayor, who is paying all the medical bills for the goalkeeper who was machine-gunned at the Africa Cup of Nations. But of course, that's not something we in the media talk about, so we won't talk about it today, because we only talk about it when I talk about how footballers are bad and selfish. No, just kidding. We will get to this. Hopefully either in the next episode or the following one. Before we get to our quick hits, also known as Off the Fence, I do want to make a quick statement. People have taken issue with the fact that sometimes I put on a funny voice when I'm trying to illustrate a contentious dunderhead type point of view. I just want to assure people this is not meant to be my impression of the average English person. No, it's my impression of the average stupid person. And when I appear on radio in England or in the United States or in Italy or in Spain, I do pretty much the same voice, because I don't do accents.
What, an English? The stupid person is always represented by an English person.
No, quite the opposite. It's just the stupid person voice. Like, you know, it's like for saying, like, oh, Michael Owen will always get you goals.
Or, well, can we hear it? Can we hear you doing the Italian version of that voice, please?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, Cannavaro deve giocare sempre.
Well, that just sounds more intelligent, because it's Italian, doesn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly, yes.
Sounds like... Well, that philosopher.
Okay, time for some quick hits. I'm going to go over the rules for, I don't know if Ducker remembers them. I will be asking you a question. You will answer the question in a maximum of 25 seconds. If you go over, I will start playing my duck horn like this, at which point you will be expected to wrap your question up pronto, so we don't have any of this long-winded waffling, which the producer absolutely hates. Manchester United are held to a draw by Bolton. Paddy, what was more surprising to you? Sir Alex substituting Wayne Rooney after an hour with the game in the balance, presumably with an eye towards a Champions League, or Michael Owen's 200th goal? And what, if anything, does this suggest about the former boy wonder? And that's Owen, not Rooney.
Well, it suggests that his ability to take a chance when it's presented is undimmed. It's become his new skill, that near post header. He did it at Newcastle from a position just behind the two, so that was no surprise at all. Nor, I'm afraid, was the Wayne Rooney withdrawal. If you went to see Wayne Rooney now, you saw him fresh through a scout's eye, you'd say, don't touch him with a barge pole.
Last week, certain soft southern types in this very studio, who will go unnamed, Matt Dickinson and Stuart Robson, and also Ollie Kay, who's not southern but is clearly equally soft, they all mocked Big Sam Allardyce's assertion that he'd win the double every year if he were managing Real Madrid or Inter Milan. James, you're a hard northerner. Will you stick up for Big Sam now that he's joint sixth in the table after the 2-1 win at Blackpool?
Well, I've never been described as hard before, Gabriel, but...
Relative to Ollie Kay, I think you're hard, yes?
Yes.
Yeah, right. Yeah, possibly. I love Big Sam dearly, but I'm sorry, he was just talking utter tripe, wasn't he? And it was a bit of an insult, I have to say, to his good friends, Alex Ferguson and the likes of Jose Mourinho. He's doing very well at Blackburn, but he's probably where he deserves to be.
Sam Allardyce.
Can we give special mention to Sam's goal celebration against Blackpool, where he did a sort of yee-haw cowboy lassoing, which I've never seen a Premiership manager do. It was incredible.
I just want to say, I don't want to be the one to say it for Sam Allardyce, but I just want to point out that I think there are at least 10 managers in the Premier League who are a lot worse and unintelligent and less intelligent than he is.
You're probably right.
Good week for Liverpool circa 2001. In addition to Jared and Owen, Heskey scored as well, notching the winner for Houllier's league debut away to Wolves. Alisson, should Houllier build Villa's attack around this retro version of Big M? And if not, who?
I feel so vindicated. I feel I've been a lone voice for the past 6 years saying that Emile was a great, great player.
You and Fabio Capello, clearly.
He is a great, great player. Managers adore him because he does exactly what they ask him to do and he works incredibly hard and is okay. His goal scoring record since he left Liverpool has not been astonishing, but what he gives to the team is so much more than that. And if he's feeling happy because his old boss is back, then fantastic. Build the team around him.
Sorry, Egbonlahor. Enjoy the bench. Ha ha.
Enough of this. I've got a question for you, Gab, and it's strictly football now. Lots of surprising results around Europe this weekend. Lyon, okay, maybe it's not a surprise that they were beaten by Saint-Etienne, but it's certainly, given Lyon's great years of success, a bit of an eyebrow raiser. Mainz in Germany winning the sixth straight match away to Bayern, no less. Mourinho's Real Madrid only drawing at Levante, losing top spot in La Liga, and Inter defeated at crisis-torn Roma 1-0. Which of them stands out the most for you?
Well, Lyon is a fantastic story because they're second bottom. Saint-Etienne, of course, they're huge rivals, declining. Haven't won a league title since 1981, but wonderful to see them at the top. Mainz, great story as well. Thomas Tuchel, you can read all about him in the game today, or on Monday, if you're listening to this after Monday. Could he be a new Mourinho in the works? The real Mourinho, Real Madrid, still up front, playing like a team of individuals. It's going to take him time, lots of time. And finally, Rafa Benitez drops the points, but Inter actually played reasonably well. Roma, dramatic 93rd minute winner, courtesy of the snake Mirko Vucinic. You can go to www.thetimes.co.uk for all your news, your gossip, your analysis, and also our web chats. I do mine every Mondays. Ollie K does it on Wednesdays. You can get Graham Spears, I believe, on Thursdays. You can also write to us, gamepodcast@timesonline.co.uk, or you can follow us on Twitter. So many wonderful ways to be in touch. We'll catch you next week. Take care.
Listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.